the one agenda item that we have is to receive. I know that Paul and our newest economist have been working hard to prepare these two reports on two initiatives that will have huge consequences if passed on the state budget and the effects. And so we will receive the legislative revenue report. And if we could, since there's fewer of us than in the previous room, if we can just jump right in rather than holding questions towards the end with a dense report, I think that would be the most useful. That's all right with our two economists.
Mr. Chair, before we get started, is this same presentation happening next door this afternoon, or is it going to be a little different? Because they're also looking at 41 and 48.
Senator, it'll be these. We'll go through these research reports. I would anticipate it'll be a little different just because of the difference in the committees. But we'll go through the same factual material.
Okay.
First, Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. A note on the agenda, we do have listed to have some discussion with the Governor's Office and Superintendent of Public Instruction's Office due to a combination of scheduling conflicts and I think a general concern about the complexity of these measures and not wanting to have a discussion at this early point. We're it. It'll just be Chris and I, so that'll be the agenda. And then, of course, the questions that you have of us and any discussion or any further work you'd like us to do. We have in front of you two research reports. The first I'll go through is Measure 48. And the second one that Chris will walk through with you is Measure 41. We have worked closely with the Financial Impact Statement Committee, and our numbers match those, and we've stayed close to those estimates. One thing that is a little different on the 41 estimates that Chris has, he has updated them for the forecast you just heard today. So you do have that slight difference as things get updated, but by and large there are the same numbers and same methodology there in the financial impact statement. The research report on 48 has also with it a companion shorter piece on the Measure 48 outline. It's what it's titled, and that's what I'm going to walk through with you and kind of go through limits, what NCSL calls TELs, which are tax and expenditure limits, and walk through those a little bit with you. And really the what I've tried to do here is a couple of things. One is give you a framework for looking at these limits, because they're not the same. I mean, they vary widely across states, and they vary widely in their impact and implications. So one way to look at them is to look at the framework and see what makes a key difference in terms of how much they may affect fiscal policy. There's also characteristics that NCSL has identified as being most limiting in terms of how they may affect future decisions of the legislature. I'll talk a little bit about limits around the country, and I do have a detailed table in the full report on what all the states do, what the targets they use, and so forth, to give you an idea of what's out there. A little bit on Oregon's history. And then, of course, some detailed discussion of Measure 48 itself. And what I've done is compare it with our current statutory appropriations limit, which went into effect in 2001, compared it with Measure 8, which was on the ballot in 2000, was defeated, but also is basically sponsored by and was developed by Don McIntyre. And, of course, Don has played a key role in the development of this one. The other thing I have in that comparison is the Colorado Tabor a constitutional limit, which has gotten the most publicity of the limits. Finally, I've got some projections, both historical projections, which are really done by Legislative Fiscal Office, and can talk about those a little bit. And then I've given you a couple of projections and assumptions to make. And I think what you'll see is that the results are pretty sensitive to what assumptions you make. But at least you get a sense of what those implications might be. So the first thing on the framework is that the number one criteria is the method of codification. Is it statutory or constitutional? And that of course makes a significant difference in terms of the flexibility of those limits. Many states have statutory limits, including Oregon, and in fact it's broken down the middle. The 14 states that have a constitutional limit, 14 that have a statutory limit, then there's two states that have both, constitutional and statutory, and Oregon is one of those two.
Before this initiative.
Yes, and the reason for that, and sometimes we don't think of it this way, but the 2% surplus kicker is a revenue limit and has been classified as a revenue limit since it first was approved by the legislature in 1979. So we are seen as a state with both a revenue limit and a spending limit.
So why are we such an outlier? I know that's somewhat of a... such an outlier in our activity on this issue. We're one of the two states with a revenue and a spending limit already, and up for it again. Is it just the initiative process that we have, or could there be?
Well, there, Mr. Chair, I think there is a tendency for the Western states, partly because they're initiative oriented, to tend to have been more involved in limits. Colorado's the other state, another Western state that has both a revenue limit and a spending limit. The movement toward limiting government really came out of California. Of course, we're in close proximity. Washington has had a lot of history with limits, too. They have a fairly stringent limit, but it is a statutory limit. So, I think a lot of it has to do with the location, proximity, and of course, the initiative process. The whole idea, really, of limits, and just to kind of take a step back and theory, why are they even proposed, what's the rationale? Well, the rationale is that the system, that the decision-making system that you participate in the legislature to develop budgets and develop revenue policy leads to too much government. I mean, that's the argument, that system, for whatever reason, there's a lot of theories for that, leads to an amount of government that's bigger than what the majority of people want. So what do you do then? You have to have some constraint on that level of government, either a revenue limit or a spending limit that, would pull it back, constrain it from being what it otherwise would be. I mean, that's the rationale. So one of the key decisions that first comes up in limits, and mostly I'm talking about spending limits because that's what most of them are, but one of the key decisions is the target. You're going to tie it to some outside force. Again, the argument is that, the normal political decision process in the legislature is going to lead to too much government. There should be some external number out there, growth figure that it should be tied to that will reflect some control or constraint on that level of spending or revenue. The next issue, which is the most complicated issue and the trickiest one legally, and I'll talk some more about that, because that's an area where I think you will, if this does pass, you'll spend a lot of time involved discussing what the limit applies to, what is subject spending. And that's very complicated and difficult to break down, because there are exceptions, and where do those exceptions apply, what's outside the limit. And we'll see that that's really was the big issue for the demise of our appropriation growth limit that was put in a statute in 79. Treatment of a surplus is a huge issue. Typically, it's a distinction between revenue and spending limits. In Colorado, for example, the surplus is returned to taxpayers as some type of tax relief, and the legislature determines that. They've used sales tax reductions, for example, to try to return those dollars. Now, Colorado, of course, has just suspended that process for 5 years as a result of the vote of the people. The other issue is the exception process. So, you know, every limit has some type of exception process. What? How do you get outside the limit? How do you, in effect, violate that limit? Usually on a one-time basis, usually it's some supermajority requirement, something that has to, extraordinary, that has to happen in order to go outside the limit. So now if you look at that framework and kind of what all limits have and what issue they all address, then my next block of characteristics there is what NCSL has identified as being the most restrictive in terms of its impact on fiscal decisions. First, of course, constitutional, and that's obviously you're going to have less flexibility for dealing with any types of exceptions. Revenue limits tend to be more restrictive, and the reason is because revenue limits require some return. You have to give that money back in some way to taxpayers, and of course the 2% surplus kicker meets that criteria. I mean, it is, you know, you have a required refund process or credit process. What we'll see is a lot of spending limits don't have any kind of are basically silent on what to do with that those excess revenues. The more restrictive limits are ones based on population plus inflation. Most limits in the country are based on personal income. So 20 states, and my number is down below, 20 states have a target tied to personal income. 7 states are tied to the projected revenue. 5 states are limited by population growth and inflation. So if you look historically, about the only time you see the growth rate in a population and inflation exceed the growth rate in personal income is in a recession. And we've developed charts on that you've seen that show that, for example, you know, the times in Oregon where it occurred were 81, 82, 2001, 2002, 1991, all recession years. Over time, personal income growth exceeds the sum of population and inflation. And that's a pretty consistent number. So, in fact, one thing I might refer you to in a bigger research report. If you look on page 3 on the big research report, the thicker one, if you look on page 3 there, you can see table 1. And table 1 shows the growth rate of Oregon population through the decades, the growth rate of the U.S. CPI, the growth rate of the sum of those two, the so-called population measure, and the growth rate of personal income. So if you look at, you know, the annual average by decade, for example, in the 60s, personal income grew 7.5% a year, population plus inflation 4.5%. So that's a huge difference over time. If you look at the 90s, personal income 6.5% per year on average, CPI plus Oregon population 4.7%. So again, that's, if you add that up each year, a 3% differential. That's a significant difference in the size of the budget 10 years from now than what it would be. And you'll see that in the projections and the historical simulations. The other interesting thing here is if you look at the 2000s, which would be 2000 to 2005, they're almost the same. Personal income has grown 3.9% on average, population 3.8%. And what that tells you is we've just gone through a recession and prolonged weakness. So the numbers that Michael was talking about today in terms of the revenue coming in and the forecast out there, by the time the decade's over, these income numbers will, in all likelihood, be far stronger than the population numbers. So the more restrictive ones have the population inflation target because that's going to grow more slowly over time. Of course, the other issue is the definition of subject spending. The broader the definition, and in fact, Colorado has limits on local revenue collections, on property tax collections that are contained within that limit. So that's very broad. In terms of Oregon's limits, our first limit that I'll talk about in a minute, our first appropriation growth limit applied only to general funds. And so you can think about some of the types of revenue sources we've had in recent years. For example, the tobacco settlement money. You know, we've never called that general fund, yet basically is. I mean, you can use it in the same way. There's no restrictions on it. So, you know, general fund becomes kind of a just a nominal thing, whatever you call it. So the more narrow the subject spending, the easier it is to avoid the limit. And then, of course, the other one is requiring a public vote. Because that public vote, normally you get a supermajority, but a public vote, of course, is a long process and a large barrier to making changes. Okay, so if we look at the limits around the country, we do have 30 states that have some type of limit. Now, you know what? One type of limit I'll mention once because it shows up is a limit on percentage of the revenue projection that you can spend. And we see a number of states that have that. You take the revenue projection, like similar to our close of session projection, and you can only appropriate 98% or 95%. So we see that type of, that's probably the most direct kind of limit. And we see a number of those around the country. Other states have these targets we talked about, either personal income or population growth plus inflation. If you look kind of at the next page on Oregon's history with the limits, we kind of go back to, in terms of the modern limit history, to the Big Bang of 1978 with California's Prop 13, and a whole series of limits were enacted shortly after that. Oregon's, what happened in Oregon was a conference committee was formed in the legislature in 79. In the latter part of the session, had the speaker and the Senate president were both on that conference committee, and they put together a package in response to the very rapid revenue growth they had in the 70s and the concerns about property taxes. Largely, they developed a property tax relief program, the old PTR program, and they also developed an appropriation growth limit as part of that package, and the 2% surplus kicker. And the legislature approved that package on a one-year basis, put it on the May 1980 primary ballot, and it got over 80%. But of course, in those days, the big concern, big discussion was property tax relief. And that's how most people, I think, discussed that limit, was not the two limits that were part of that package, but rather the property tax relief. So most of that property tax relief was whittled away in the 80s, and it was gone by the end of the 80s with a recession, because it was not a tax reduction, it was an expenditure, providing both renter relief and property tax relief. But the appropriation growth limit and the 2% surplus kicker stayed with us, of course. So they remained as the two elements of the package. The other thing that was kind of interesting, what happened was it passed in 79. Of course, what happened in the next two biennia is the economy went into deep recession. We're way below forecast, so the spending limit didn't apply, and neither did the 2% surplus kicker in either 79-81 or 81-83. So they didn't first come in as an issue until the mid-80s. So the 87 legislature was the first to bump up against the spending limit, and they voted by simple majority. It was a statutory limit. They voted by simple majority to exceed the limit in 87, 89, and 91. One of the things that we discovered, or that my predecessors discovered pretty quickly, was that the way the limit was designed, it had what's called a ratchet effect. You probably heard about that in Colorado, because that's been a major issue there. The limit, the original appropriation growth limit, limited general fund spending to the percentage change in personal income. that it was that personal income measure that Senator Whitsitt was asking about in the revenue forecast. You take that measure of total personal income from the prior 2 years, and the percentage change was the limit. So whatever it grew, if it grew 14%, then that was the limit on general fund spending the following biennium.
And so does this measure have the same characteristic as that in terms of ratcheting down? That was the whole discussion of Colorado undoing their Tabor was, I think even the governor who had proposed it. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the real fatal flaws of
it. Mr. Chair, it did have the ratcheting effect, and it came into play immediately because the economy goes into recession. It's general fund only. Of course, we all know what happens to general fund revenue in a recession, and it happened even much more pronounced then. The revenue dropped below the spending limit. The spending limit was based on income growth from 78 to 80, and then you're looking at 79, 81, you're seeing, okay, I can grow this amount, I can spend this amount more. Then you're looking at your revenue, and you don't have nearly enough revenue to spend up to the limit. So what happens when you look at the next biennium, you're not looking at the old limit, you're looking at what you spent. So you're ratcheted down, and you percentage change from that new lower level. You rebase it to either to the lowest of either how much revenue you have or to what the limit is. So when revenue falls below the limit, you're permanently rebased downward. And then it's a percentage change from that level. And that's what really happened in Colorado. Colorado, their numbers were pretty phenomenal in the volatility they went through. They were a very high growth state in the late 90s, really one of the top growing states in employment in 99-2000, and they dropped right to the bottom. And, of course, the revenue did, too. They're not as dependent on the income tax, but it is an important source of revenue. So their revenue was way below what they could spend under the limit. So they went down to that lower level, and then once recovery started, revenue picks up, they can only grow the amount of the limit from that new lower base. So that's the ratcheting effect. It occurs whenever you have a percentage change target. So whether it be population inflation or personal income, as long as it's a percentage change target, then you have the ratcheting effect, the ratcheting possibility. So just kind of a little bit more on the history. In 91, of course, implementation of Measure 5. The thing about Measure 5 that was important for the appropriation growth limit is that the limit allowed an exception for property tax relief. Remember, that was the whole package that went together, was the property tax relief really wasn't spending, it's tax relief. So and I remember participating in this bureaucratic decision, basically interpreted it, well, Measure 5 is property tax relief. And the school replacement calculation that was done in this office in the early 90s, that was property tax relief. So you take, you know, over $2 billion out of the general fund and say, well, it's not subject to the limit because it's property tax relief. The other thing that happened was in 91, the legislature in the waning moments approved use of video poker. And that started in 91. And that, of course, became a very strong growth item. That's not general fund. So it was outside the limit. So you had what was kind of the discretionary budget when you looked at general fund lottery. About 40% of it was not counted as part of the limit. So it became kind of a meaningless limit, is what happened. So, and so we began to look at things. I know in after the 95 session, the Revenue Committee issued a report. They did an interim study, and it was part of their interim agenda to look at the limit. Legislature started to look at it, but it was really in 2000 that we really started looking at it more seriously because Measure 8 was on the ballot. And that was a very broad limit. I'll talk about that in a minute, but that raised a number of issues about the current limit at that time, which it was not very operational. So following the defeat of Measure 8, the 2001 legislature repealed the appropriation growth limit and replaced it with a new statutory limit. And that's what you have in effect right now, is a new statutory limit. The main thing, they did two things that were trying to deal with the problems we had diagnosed from the appropriations limit. They took away the ratcheting effect by making it a percent of total personal income, 8%. So what that means is that if you drop to 7%, the next biennium you can grow faster than income to catch up to the 8%. So you can catch up if you drop behind, so you're not permanently ratcheted down. The other thing they did was they had a broader definition of what's subject to spending. So they made it much broader than general fund. And so, and I'll talk about that in a minute when we look at our table. But it's they defined it as something that would include a lot of government spending beyond simply the general fund. Okay, so that's kind of where we are now. We're looking at, we have a current statutory spending limit, and of course we have a constitutional revenue limit in the 2% surplus kicker that was put in the Constitution in 2000. The Measure 48, in terms of its basic characteristics, first of all, and this is where, you know, you come into, you get a lot of comparisons with the Colorado Tabor, the biggest difference is it's a spending limit. It's a limit on spending. It's not a revenue limit. And as a result of that, most spending limits, it's silent on what happens when you get more revenue than you can spend, that surplus revenue. Of course, we still have the kicker in effect, and the kicker would be completely unaffected by this. It uses the inflation population growth as its target. So the more restrictive target, it uses a broad definition of spending, and the definition of spending is basically everything, what's called all disbursements, which we're a little unsure about exactly what that means legally because it's not a term we've used, but all disbursements with a list of exceptions. And the biggest is federal expenditures or expenditures out of federal funds. It even lists some revenue items like refunds, which, you know, we've never considered to be expenditures. Those are net negative revenues for us. And there's some others, bond sales, if they're approved by voters, is allowed. Donations, spending out of donations, higher ed, for example. So it's an all-encompassing limit with a list of exceptions, and the biggest $2 ones are federal dollars and the donation.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Dr. Warner, are workman's compensation payments included in 48?
Yes, all disbursements, public disbursements, are included unless they're expressly excluded. So, you know, if you look at kind of what's left over in this broad definition, there's percentages are what I put down. This is something LFO has calculated on the percentages of the remaining budget, and this is about $31 billion now. The total all funds budget is about $40 billion. This is about $31 billion. It's about three-fourths of that all funds budget. Of course, it's more than double the general fund budget. But you still have some of those same dominant forces, like education, which is 32%. But one that comes up, and potentially a controversial one in terms of legal definitions, is PERS payments. PERS payments are 17% of that total amount. Now, one way, if you look at Measure 48, the language is that it would be defines total spending as all disbursements pursuant to all acts by the legislature authorizing expenditure of, quote, public funds. One argument in fact, our Revenue Department director talked about during the financial impact statement process was, are those really public funds? Or are they private and under the state is just acting as a trustee, holding those funds and then dispersing them to retirees? So you're going to get those kinds of legal issues. And you can see, for example, if there's a decision that, no, that's really not part of the limit, you get a much bigger, you get a much smaller pie. I mean, it reduces it by 17%. So, but right now, we, based on the legal discussion we've had, heard so far, particularly from the AG, that those are counted within the limit. And the point I want to make is, more importantly than some of these individual categories, is that this is one of the natural issues around limits, is these definitions and these legal definitions and how tight they are and how can you get around them. And that will become a huge issue if this passes, because it's kind of the nature of them. The category of the kind of a catch-all category is the 14%, and this would include the unemployment compensation. This would include the worker compensation payments that Senator Whitsitt mentioned are all under that 14% for economic development. So you can see the listing down there. I've had some discussion with fiscal office, and you know, about kind of, all right, let's say this thing is in place, and you have more revenue than you can spend. Where are you likely to see the reductions? And it's, you know, their basic answer is it's real hard to say at this point, because even though you may have some more flexibility in certain areas, there may be a lot of areas, you know, fee-driven kinds of expenditures in the past that the legislature may decide not to raise those fees, even if there's a desire to do so on the part of the constituents, because it counts under the limit. So you get that kind of phenomenon, as well as kind of the typical discussion about some of the more typically discretionary type spending. So it's really hard to say initially where we would see the pressures on the budget. But I'll show you in a few minutes about where we would project spending to be in the absence of the limit versus what it would be under the limit. And it's a pretty big difference.
But also, given what we just heard, I mean, it's hard for me to imagine a scenario where education, higher education, and human services, if the forecast holds and we're up and then moving down and you ratchet down, I just, because you have such little discretion over transportation corrections, where that's the only places that you would reduce, is, I would think, is human services, education, and higher ed.
That's one way to look at it, Mr. Chair. But you know, and that could well be what happens. But some of these other areas, as I say, if we look at particularly under that big 14% under the economic development, employment service, housing, veterans, and so forth, some of those expenditures can be moved around through time. For example, they may be lumpy in terms of investment type expenditures. So you may see some of that as well.
Senator Shields.
When I was chairing natural resources, all the various agricultural commissions would come in, like the wheat commission and so on. You're saying that even if those wheat farmers all wanted to raise their own fee on themselves to benefit their industry, they probably wouldn't want to do it, or the legislature wouldn't want to do it, because it would affect this whole scenario.
Senator, well, yeah, what I'm saying is you'd have to take that into account. I mean, that would be the next question. Somebody would come to you and say, we want to do this. Your next question would be, how do we sit under
it? It affects constituencies that we hadn't even thought about it affecting people driving it. Mm-hmm. It would affect a private industry out there's ability to benefit itself. With money that they always thought of as their own fee-driven money, and it was assessed on themselves, it was always interesting to me to watch that phenomenon in that committee, where a lot of farmers would come in and say, I hate taxes, but I want to do this because this is going to benefit my potato crop or my wheat or whatever. Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
Well, you know, and really I think we're talking about, if this is in effect for the upcoming session, then if you look beyond that, I think you would probably be looking at some institutional kinds of changes. You know, where would you see that balloon kind of pop out? One thing would be to try to do those kind of services in a way that doesn't, quote, count as a disbursement. That could be some type of privatization. It could be... what I thought would happen, and I thought made this argument with Measure 8 as well in 2000, that you would start to see a lot of pressure to shift responsibilities and revenue, if it can't be spent at the state level, down to the local level. And you know, a lot of the expenditures, you look at these categories here, most of them are some combination of state and local. And so you would tend to see ways that would shift fiscal responsibilities outside the limit in some way, or at least there'd be a lot of discussion of that.
It's just Colorado, spending a little time in Colorado, higher education was the one that had the most difficulty at all fitting in anywhere to that scenario. And so basically just they felt the biggest brunt of Tabor, it seemed, was UC, the UC system and University of Colorado, because they just couldn't adapt given the structure of the university. Senator Woodson.
You're still hung up on the workers' compensation, Chair. Dr. Warner, I look at the workers' compensation more as an insurance premium that is paid by the employer, held in the premiums are held in trust by a state agency and is paid out to the employer, the employee who's lost a job as a benefit, his insurance benefit. Is that the legislature does have the authority and often exercises the authority to extend that benefit, but isn't that pretty much how the workman's compensation program works?
So, Senator, you'd be talking about payments that would come from SAFE, from the SAFE Corporation.
Yes.
No, I believe those would not be counted under the limit.
I'm sorry?
I believe those would not be counted under the limit because SAFE would be a non-governmental entity.
So
those are not a budgeted item. So it would have to be a budgeted item.
So the literature that we were receiving is suggesting that all the leeway would be taken up by workman's compensation payments may not be accurate then.
Maybe I should confer on that. But my understanding is that it has to be at a budgeted item as a disbursement. If SAFE is a standalone corporation, which I believe it is, and we had this discussion under Measure 8 as well, that it would be it has to be a public disbursement of funds. So something like unemployment compensation, for example, which is the discussion I've heard a lot of, is subject to the limit because that's a state expenditure. But I will do a little research on that, and I haven't looked at that for a couple of years to see how that would fit under this limit. But I'll look that up and send the committee a more thorough explanation.
That's a good question.
Chair.
Yeah, sir.
I want to follow up, Paul, if we could, on the higher ed. I'm looking at the report. I think it's just the full report on page 9. It talks about donations are an important source of revenue for higher ed institutions around the state. Can you walk us through, in the sense of if someone decides to make a donation to either the University of Oregon, Portland State, OSU, and that money's taken into the school, is that something that's going to be caught into on the dispersal side when they start using it? That would be within impact from Measure 48?
Senator, one of the things that we've noticed, and looking at these both from an expenditure side and from a revenue side, a lot of these so-called other fund items, we haven't tracked that closely. They show up in our accounting formats. If you look at the governor's budget, for example, there's a whole section in the back of all the different revenue sources from other funds. So it's not something that's been tracked that closely. What would have to happen under the limit is those things would have to be tracked much more closely than they are now. If you look at, there is a revenue category called donations. And in the latest numbers I've seen, it's around $5 billion working from donations. So it's not an insignificant amount of money. But it would have to be something that would be tracked more closely, and then it would have to be broken out as expenditures that were made from a donation. So when you look at the higher ed budget, they would have federal funds pulled out, donations pulled out as not counting under the limit. So I think it certainly would, Measure 48 would certainly change our tracking systems and make us much more conscious of some of these areas that really are not even limited to a great extent. I mean, basically, these are outside revenue sources, and the spending entity essentially gets them and spends them in an unlimited way.
So, if I could follow, then that would tell me that, based on what we just heard about how the SAFE Corporation would not be impacted, would OSHU, OHSU, would they be also in the same scenario since they are a spinoff or a not a public corporation, not a state agency?
My understanding is that they would be, or a portion of them would be, because they are part of the expenditure process.
So they get some money, but maybe the money that's... I'm just trying to get a bigger picture of this. I mean, are we going to see a lot of people, agencies or whatever, coming in and saying, we want to be some type of public corporation?
Well, they could, make it a direct appropriation, so that money is obviously going to be included. And plus, we did the big Oregon opportunity, which was, it's in effect the train that's part of that whole South Waterfront project is, and that would all be affected because of that $500 million appropriation, 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Our bond sales.
Yes, and that the other issue may be affected would be bond sales and bond programs, because bond programs and proceeds from that are counted under the limit unless they're approved in a voter process. Like we do have some recent history of that. For example, the pension obligation bonds went before a vote; those were approved by voters, so those we would assume would not be in the limit. But if they're not approved by voters, then we assume that they would be. The other thing that we know would be subject to the limit would be any kind of repayment. So you may get proceeds from the bond sales, but the going forward, the debt payments would be counted under the limit.
So, just on that would seem that, let's say for whatever reason we had a good year, we decided we want to pay the bonds off early, which would mean you'd be paying more out during that one cycle. Those type of decisions could be impacted, and we may have to actually incur more interest payments or rates and not be able to pay down the debt sooner.
Or hold bonds,
yeah.
I couldn't see it certainly affecting the timing of some of those decisions.
Right.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Werner, back to the unemployment insurance. It's my understanding that it's really not a tax, that is an insurance premium. If it's an insurance premium, then the state would hold those accumulated funds in trust as a fiduciary too, and so I'm a little hard put to see how that would come under this Measure 48, and I'm neither an economist nor a lawyer, but how is that tax revenue if it is actually collected as a result of an insurance premium and paid out as an insurance premium and paid out as an insurance benefit?
Senator, in fact, the term that you just used of a fiduciary is part of the current language of the current statute that is, quote, governmental activity is the only thing subject to the limit, which excludes fiduciary activities explicitly. So those are not in the current appropriation limit. The discussion of whether it's a whether it's a trust obligation or not, I think really revolves around this disbursement language. And it says disbursements pursuant to all acts of the Legislative Assembly. And so expenditure of public funds. So, I think the legal interpretation there is that it doesn't, whether it's a tax or not is not the relevant issue, because there's a lot of these funds that are not tax supported. They come from fees and other kinds of revenue sources. So they are, however, dispersed as a result of legislative budgetary action. So that's kind of the argument that's that encompassing definition of the limit, unless it meets one of these exceptions, and there's no exception language that would suggest those should be pulled out for trust activities, for example.
But hasn't there been quite a lot of discussion about whether those are actually public funds or not?
Well,
whether they actually belong to those who have paid the premium.
Senator, I think that's exactly right. That gets back to the issue that I brought up earlier with the PERS. is that authorizing the expenditure of, quote, public funds? So that issue is still to be decided. The calculations we have done include them in the total spending limit as, you know, looking at this disbursement language. Now, that would be subject to challenge. And again, I think this gets back to, you know, the most complicated part of any limit is what is subject and what is not. And so, and, you know, we're working with, you know, basically a paragraph defining that. So I think there's a number of issues like that out there. And that, you know, those would have to be worked out. You know, one way to do it would be some type of statutory accompanying language, or, of course, the others through the court system. You know, the state would have to interpret it the way it could, and then there could be challenges.
Well, certainly PERS, the PERS trust fund is derived from public funds.
Yes.
But do you feel that your retirement is public funds?
Well, I think that, you know, I mean, it's... Yeah,
I understand.
But it also gets to that, to me anyway, it, not being a lawyer, but it gets to kind of the institutional framework. You know, whether this is legislatively determined as and decided upon as a public something, a public entity versus a something a quasi public or private entity. It's making those decisions.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay. The next thing I wanted to refer you to, and we'll try to get to Chris here quickly, on table 3 gives you kind of the comparison that we talked about between 48 current Oregon spending limit, Measure 8, and Colorado's TABOR. TABOR is the only one that's a true revenue limit. All are constitutional except for the current Oregon spending limit. The targets, the Measure 8 target was, interestingly, was also a percent of income. It was a bigger percent, but it was a much broader definition of spending. And this really, I think, engendered a lot of discussion about the ratcheting effect we talked about, because Measure 8 had a percent of income target. Measure 48, of course, has the more restrictive population plus inflation, as does Colorado's TABOR, and as does Washington's Initiative 601. The subject spending for the we talked about it under Measure 48 for the governmental activities is the current definition, and it excludes these business and fiduciary activities, and it excludes spending from federal funds, bond proceeds, and tuition remission programs. The fiduciary responsibilities, which gets into the trust fund activities, unemployment compensation, PERS, retiree payments, and so forth, where the government is acting as a trust, and business activities, and, you know, this would be where you're collecting payments for a direct service. So those are not included. There still is in this, and budget management will tell you that when they look at those different components, there's some subjectivity in terms of defining some of those kinds of activities. So it's certainly not, you know, a bright line distinction when you're looking at the various components of the budget. Measure 8 was extremely broad. The only thing it excluded was spending from bond proceeds. Most state revenue sources, and this is where we get the distinction with the revenue limits, are included under Colorado's TABOR. And they do include unemployment taxes. They include higher ed fees and tuition. It includes transportation taxes and fees, and does have limits on local government revenue. So it's a broad definition, and the Colorado legislature issued a very detailed and good report on tracking those components if anyone's ever interested. The treatment of the surplus, there is no provision in Measure 48, none in the current statute. There's no excess revenue refund requirement. The exception process, excuse me, under the current statute, requires a three-fifths vote, but it's statutory, so you know that has its limits. It can be changed with a majority vote. Measure 48 has a two-thirds legislative vote, and what's a little different about it is it does require approval by voters, and it does state in the petition that it be in a general election. So it's so you've got kind of a, that would affect the time frame certainly for any kind of an exception process.
So how would you? That was, given that we're biannual legislature that budgets biannually, you'd be sitting there. Say you did have a Colorado type situation before they took their time out of education and higher education spending was getting into uncomfortable, at least for some folks, position. You would have, but they didn't have. Did they have the same where you'd have to wait to a general election? Because then you'd really, in effect, be waiting a year and a half. And I don't know how you would do that, pass a budget, saying it almost renders it meaningless because you'd have to wait a year and a half out to get your verdict, whether you could do this or not.
Mr. Chair, I think you'd have to be, you know, as a practical matter, you'd almost have to be looking ahead to the next biennium. It would have to be. It, to me, I think it would be more of kind of a structural thing where you would have, for some reason, you would see that looking out over the next two or three biennium, as Colorado did, you know, with the ratcheting effect there, they're saying we've got economic recovery projected the next couple of fiscal years, therefore we can ask for a suspension. So it would have to be some kind of a multi-year planning rather than a, you know, a one-time recognition that, you know, that the limit will affect one biennium.
I think it would force the state to budget annually. I mean, trying to predict out 2 years, and I just think that would be just really difficult.
The Measure 8 actually required a three-fourths vote, but had no election to it, and Colorado requires voter approval, as they just went through in November of 2005. So, you know, if you look at Measure 48 and kind of see how it stacks up with these other limits, it does have a lot of the characteristics of Colorado's Tabor, but again, the most important difference, the most important difference is that it's, you know, it's a spending limit, not a revenue limit. It does not have the surplus revenue requirement. So what would happen is, and you'll see under these projections, is you and the legislature making decisions. You know, we'd be giving you a lot more detailed numbers on what, you know, all funds revenue looks like. Not just general fund, but you'd be looking at, you know, revenue that would potentially be subject to the limit. And if you're looking at a big difference between those two, then you'd have to decide what are you going to do with that revenue. And, you know, I know there's a lot of discussion about that. Some have talked about, well, it could go to reserve fund, or it could be through some permanent tax reductions. The other thing to recognize here is, and you'll see in these projections that, you know, and this is the point the proponents always make, we're not talking about a decrease on a year-to-year basis in spending. You're talking about a slower rate of growth relative to revenue. So some of those items, those discretionary revenue items like the fees and other things, the decision could be, well, why raise them in the first place if they can't be, you know, they can't be spent under the limit. So you'll see that kind of behavior too. On the historical simulation, what I did was start with 89-91, and again, basically, these historical numbers were done by budget management and fiscal office. If you look at the rate of growth in the subject spending, these are the things that we would assume under the broader definition on what's subject to the limit. The average biennial change from 89-91 to the 2005-07 approved budget is 14%, about 7% a year. The average change under the target, Measure 48 target, is 10%. So a 4% differential. So if you take that same $11 billion starting point, 89-91, and you project out to 2005-07, actually the state is spending $31.4 billion under the limit, it would spend $23.5 billion, or a difference of just about 25%, $7.9 billion. Now, of course, one of the things that is important is, when does the limit start when you start these simulations? Because there are rates of change. So I wanted to look at another time period, 9901, and you can see that actually the majority of that $5 billion difference accumulated over the last three biennium. And it's not due to an acceleration of subject spending growth. It's actually a little bit less, 13.6% versus 14. It's due to a deceleration of the Measure 48 target, which is population inflation. Of course, we've had a low inflation environment over the last 5 years, and we've also had a slowdown in the population growth, which during the early 90s, early to mid-90s, we had a pretty significant rate of population growth. So those two components have slowed down. So now if you look at the rates of growth over the last three biennia, the target is exactly half of what actually happened, 6.8 versus 13.6. So that is a significant difference. If the legal issues and definitions aside, this would have had a significant effect on your decision process and on your budget. So, one of the things that we always talk about is the past is the past. That gives us something based on reality. But on the other hand, we don't know what, we know a lot of things in the past. The recent past are not going to repeat themselves. So what do the projections show? What I tried to do is look at the trend projections in terms of relating the subject spending to this personal income variable, which is a measure of the overall economy, and also is, of course, what we're tied to in our current limit. So what I did was I took that entire period of 89-91 to 05-07 and looked at the relationship with personal income, and actually personal income grew 0.2%, or spending grew 0.2% relative to personal income. So what that means is that we're growing slightly as a share of personal income, and I projected that out. And that first block of numbers under current law projections is difference from Measure 48. And you can see the Measure 48 growth rates there, 8.2, 6.9, and 6.8. And so, and the growth rates under the economic forecast are 14.1, 13.6, and 13.0, which is similar to what we've seen historically. So there's the difference, $1.8 billion in 07-09, $4.4 billion in 09-11, $7.2 in 11-13. These are all trend projections, no recessions built in. Then I took it that shorter period of time where we've seen stronger growth relative to income, actually gaining 0.3% on income each biennium, and plugged that in, and then there's where I get the bigger numbers, and these actually are closer to what's on the financial impact statement. $2.1 billion in 07-09, about $5 billion in 09-11, about a little over $8 billion in 11-13. So there is a lot of sensitivity, just in the first biennium, over $200 million difference, which seems like a pretty innocuous difference in the two assumptions. So it is sensitive. But I think clearly the conclusion is, under this limit, we're going to have slower growth in overall spending. Now, I think that would be, and that, of course, is the objective. I mean, if you talk to the proponents, that's their main objective, is to have slower rate of growth. And history and our projections give us any reasonable guides. I think that's the case. We cannot, however, be completely certain with that conclusion, because of, number one, some of the legal issues Senator Whitsitt has raised, but also include in terms of what kind of institutional flexibility there would be. So you may have, subject spending going down, but you may have some of this other institutional phenomena we've talked about, that redefinitions mean similar kinds of spending is no longer under the limit and defined in a way that doesn't count under the limit, whether it's through some other type of provision. So that would be a phenomenon that we would track and look at and see how the system responded.
Thank you. You put a lot of time. I talked to you on the phone a few times when you were working on this report. I know it required a great deal of work putting the data together, and I think it'll be used by hopefully a lot of Oregonians to at least size up what this measure would mean to our state.
Well, I was worried about getting it done. I didn't want to have to come before you and tell you that my beagle chewed it up. I didn't have it done in time. So
he does have a beagle. Questions or comments on it before we move to measure 41?
Simple question. Have the media been able to talk to you or digest this in any way, shape, or form? Is there any interest in it? I mean, this is more complex than they often get.
Senator, you know, we've just released this, and we try to time our releases for our committee meetings, so, you know, you first to have it. I've had some discussion, not too much with the media. Where I've had the most interest, city clubs, for example, Portland City Club is working on both a Measure 48 and a Measure 41 report, and I've had some discussions with them. We've had, of course, various interest groups that are interested in the spending limit. LFO has really done much more of the detailed work in terms of the spending categories, as you'd expect, and they've had a number of questions about, you know, what would be under the limit and what wouldn't be. But we'll put this out on our web, and hopefully it could be at least a basis for discussion.
Mr. Chair, just a comment. Seems to me, looking at this, that Measure 48 is really an attempt to get to force government to live within the private sector inflation paradigm. And if it does become part of our Constitution, it seems to me that would really change the focus of the Revenue Committee from raising more revenue to becoming more efficient in how we spend those funds, and probably in selectively reducing state government in certain areas. If there's just a comment.
I don't disagree that it would definitely. Although I mean, one of the questions I had is, and I guess based on that comment, is as you looked at other states, and is this a particular? I mean, I know of no private organization that has any even large organization that uses such sort of spending cap. Is it particular to West? I mean, you opened with Western states. Is there other local, federal, global governments, organizations that have any formulas similar to this? I know if we pass this, we would be, I think especially with Colorado, likely the strictest far and away at that point of any state in the nation. But is there a country, a large organization that you can look at and say, well, they've employed a formula similar to this?
Mr. Chair, the closest thing that I would imagine would be a possibility would be Canada. I've seen some reference in the, on websites looking at provincial limits because they've had some of these kinds of issues. And of course, the Western Canadian provinces in particular have had some provincial governments that have really tried to limit government and reduce its size. But I don't know of it in European countries. I think it really gets back to this, again, this what I call a public choice review of the public choice process and how it works. And it does have to begin with this argument that there's something else needs to be there other than what, you know, a current parliamentary or legislative system will give you. And so it's obviously an attempt to lay something on above that. And so it's, you know, it's certainly the modern version of it has grown out of the initially from California. I mean, you go back before that, and you know, state and local government growth was very strong. You know, in the post-war period, extremely strong until the late 70s, and it was kind of a backlash to that. And we've seen, you know, continual interest in this. And there was a Maine passed in 05, Maine passed the statutory limit. So we still see discussion. Wisconsin passed one fairly recently. So we still see you know, interest in it. I think you do tend to see more when the economy picks up, too. I mean, there's a concern that because you see higher growth rates in the public sector.
Mm-hmm. So. Have we ever cataloged LRO? I'm trying to just draw my six or so, well, I don't even know how many years. How many tax increases the legislature has approved that have gone into effect in the last, I'm trying to think from, say, 1990 to today. How many, I mean, other than a transportation-specific, general tax increases has the legislature approved and became law in Oregon?
Well, you know, the one thing, Mr. Chair, I know that we, you know, our reconnects on occasion have had revenue increases as a result of those combinations of what the federal government did. That was particularly true in the early to mid-90s when the federal government was broadening the base. You know, that would result in an increase. But I can't think of a general increase. We've had cigarette tax increases. Of course, we had a 10-cent increase in the early 90s, and that was the famous two-year 10-cent increase that eventually did go away. But I can't think of a broad tax increase. It's more or less tended to be incidental to some.
You know, I think it would be interesting to get, if we could, and if we could do it before November, since this is, there's a political season to this, how many, I'd like to see it, how many tax reduction times we've done general tax reductions through this body that have become law, and how many times we've done general tax increases that have become, that I'm familiar with one attempt.
One attempt. That's one, the 2152, which became Measure 30.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the one that we as a legislature and the governor agreed needed to happen at that time. Mm-hmm. Referred a referendum, actually, and were rejected by the people.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the comparison with that, and we put this in our research report and tried to scale all the numbers with Measure 30, was the 82 special session, and then the 83 legislature, which made permanent and extended the rate increases and had cigarette tax increase and a series of other things. So that was the biggest tax increase percentage-wise as a percentage of income that I know of.
27 years ago.
So, Mr. Chair, Paul, one of the things that seems pretty ironic here is that what this doesn't include is new initiatives that come forward from the people that ask us to provide additional services that cost money. I mean, Measure 11, no right or wrong as to what the impact has been except on the financial requirements of the state, and that just seems that what we're seeing potentially if 48 passes, there's still no check and balance on what initiatives may be brought before the voters to pass to ask for or require additional spending from the state with no offset. Is that correct? I mean, I assume that there's no exemption in place for new spending requirements that are imposed on the state through the initiative process.
Senator, you know, that is an exception to our current statutory language. There is a provision in there as an exception, as voter-approved initiatives in our current language.
So that no impact from 48 then? In other words, if we had a new measure...
No, this would be for spending required under a new limit, under a new initiative. So something like Measure 11 under our current statutory limit would create an exception. Under Measure 48, it would not. Of course, 48 would supersede the current limit because it would be constitutional.
Right. So for clarity, in 2 years from now, if there was another initiative, let's say a similar to Measure 11, requiring for longer sentencing, causing the state to expend more money in building more prisons for the welfare of those individuals, inmates, etc., would that be those new expenses, would those be exempt, or they would be captured under 48 under the cap of the spending?
Senator, those would be subject to the Measure 48 limit.
Okay, thank you.
There would be no, there's no exception in that, right, in that Measure 48.
Thank you very much. Measure Chris, you were in charge of Measure 41. Hasn't received as much attention, but it has pretty big implications itself.
It's probably much more concise, if that's the term. But, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. And in front of you, you have two documents labeled Measure 41, Changing Oregon's Treatment of Personal Exemptions. One is a larger research report, and the other one is labeled Summary, and that's what I'm going to walk through. And it's kind of a highlights of the report itself. So I'm just going to walk through this. It's a 3- or 4-pager. And I'm going to start by just describing current law and what Measure 41 does. And I'm going to talk a bit about the history of Oregon's treatment of personal exemptions, and then I'll discuss the revenue impact of the measure and some of the detailed revenue impacts in terms of distributional impact and the impact on specific taxpayers, or taxpayer groups, rather. Under current law, each taxpayer is entitled to one personal exemption for him or herself, one for a spouse, and one for each dependent. And in 06, that amount was $159, or will be $159. There are also additional exemption credits that may be claimed by the if the taxpayer and the spouse has a severe disability, and one for each, and then one additional exemption credit for each handicapped child, where severe disability and handicapped are defined in statute. Measure 41 essentially allows taxpayers the option of using the existing personal exemption credit or their federal personal exemption deduction that is claimed on the federal return. In 2007, that federal deduction amount is $3,400. Measure 41 first takes effect in 2007, and it is a statutory measure. And just to provide some context for the number of exemptions that are claimed each year, in 2004, which is the most recent year for which we have actual data, there were just over 1.6 million returns filed and roughly 3.4 million personal exemptions claimed, so roughly 2 per return. And generally speaking, with a single return, you will either have one exemption credit or zero. Zero would be dependents who are not allowed to claim a personal exemption. Because they are claimed on another taxpayer's return. Typically, these would be children, high school kids, for example, who have a job and are claimed on their parents' tax return, so they would be unaffected. And then joint returns, the number of personal exemptions can be thought of kind of as a proxy for a household. You know, a family of four would typically claim 4 exemption credits. Before I get to some of the numbers, I just want to touch on a few of the uncertainties in the language of the measure. And certain assumptions about these had to be made to put some numbers together, and the assumptions that were made here are consistent with those made by the Fiscal Impact Committee work. First of all, the additional exemption credits for the severe disability and handicapped children are not mentioned by the measure. So these estimates assume that those credits still exist and they are unaffected by the measure. And by unaffected, I mean different ways to interpret it would be if those exemption credits are still allowed, if the taxpayer chooses to use the federal exemption deduction, or if that exemption credit amount is an additional, rather than being an additional exemption credit, it's an additional deduction. So it can have effect either way, either increasing the revenue impact or lowering it. The second issue pertains to non-resident filers. Non-residents file Form 40N, and for the most part, the deductions that they claim on that return are prorated by the share of their Oregon income divided by the federal income. For example, the standard deduction is prorated. Now, the language of Measure 41 says that the deduction shall not be less than the total amount of the deduction on the taxpayer's federal tax return. So it's unclear if the intent of the measure was to disallow the typical proration on the non-resident return. And so the estimates that in this paper assume that the non-resident, that the deduction would be prorated. The third uncertainty pertains to the federal AMT. And this, it depends on how you think about federal taxation, but one way to think about the federal system is that it's a dual system. You have the regular system, which most people are familiar with, and 98% of people just pay tax under the regular system. And by that, I mean the regular marginal tax rates. The AMT affects 2 to 3% of taxpayers, and the calculation for the tax is different. The rate structure is different. And how it interacts with this is that under the AMT, personal exemption deductions are not allowed under the AMT. So for Oregon, under Measure 41, when a taxpayer is determining their personal exemption deductions, if they are subject to the AMT, then their federal personal deduction amount could be considered zero because they paid tax under the AMT. And finally, the last point, the measure says that the deduction amount shall be not less than the deduction allowed for all exemptions on the federal return. Now, the numbers in here assume that all exemptions refers to all personal exemptions, although there is an interpretation where all exemptions could be much broader. And for all of these, I've been in communication with Ledge Council working through these and trying to understand them. And at this point, I'm not sure exactly what would be included in the broader interpretation of all exemptions. But for the purposes of this paper, the assumption is that it just refers to the personal exemption deductions.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Woodson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I had on the AMT, in the event that the federal exemption was zero, you could still, under the wording of this, still use your Oregon exemption, is that right?
You could at least use the Oregon exemption credit.
Yes.
You
can select either or.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So in that case, it would be unaffected.
Yes.
It depends on the point I was trying to make there was that it depends on how you think about the AMT, because if you're thinking of the tax return, the way it kind of technically works is a person fills out their 1040, they will fill in their personal exemption deduction, so there will be an amount on the federal return, and they will calculate the regular tax liability. And then there is a trigger to say, you know, if your income is above a certain amount, go to the AMT, you may owe it. And so if the taxpayer goes through that calculation and the AMT tax is greater than their regular tax, the amount that they put on their federal tax return is that incremental difference. And discussing the AMT, I've seen it done both ways, I guess. The AMT tax could be considered just that incremental difference. And in that case, the taxpayer actually claimed, they were allowed to claim the personal exemption deduction on the federal return. So it's kind of an issue of whether the AMT is that incremental amount or if it's the full liability. Okay, on the second page, the history of the Oregon for personal exemptions. When the income tax was originally created in 1929, first affecting 1930, there was an exemption deduction of $1,500 for single filers, $2,500 for joint, and then $400 for dependents. And the deduction was not indexed to inflation. And then in, I think, 1945, the joint amount was adjusted to be twice the single. But from 1930 to 1982, the personal exemption was a deduction, and the value of that deduction changed over time, but ranged from $500 to $1,500. The 1983 legislature, in response to the recession at the time, temporarily changed what was then a $1,000 deduction to an $85 credit for tax years 1983 and 1984. It was then to revert to a $1,000 deduction for 1985, indexed to inflation with 1984 as the base year. And failed to write that down, but that was a revenue raiser of, I believe, about $65 million. Then, in 1985, the legislature made changes to the exemption again, and this time the exemption credit was made permanent, and indexing was delayed until 1987, with 1986 as the base year. That, too, was a revenue raiser, and 80 or 85 million, maybe 83 million, was the amount that it raised. The graph there in Exhibit 1 is an attempt to show the value of the credit and how it has changed over time in nominal terms. And because for most of the history, the personal exemption was a deduction, what I did here was convert the deduction to a credit equivalent by multiplying the deduction amount in a given year by that year's top marginal tax rate. And over that time, 1930 to 1982, the top marginal tax rate ranged from 5% to about 11.5%. And so some of the variation there could be due to a change in the deduction amount, or it could be due to a change in the marginal tax rate. But you can see that it was fairly stable for the first 40 years or so, at around $50 to $60 per exemption. And again, these are nominal terms, not adjusted for inflation. And the right part of the graph, to the right of that solid line, is when the inflation indexing started. And you can see that the nominal rate just has kind of ticked straight up. Well, not straight up, but at a constant rate it has increased, and that reflects inflation. And then the small dashed line is the current projection for the personal exemption credit under current law. The larger dashed line reflects the change in this quote-unquote credit equivalent under Measure 41. Now, in 2007, the federal deduction is $3,400, which amounts to a credit equivalent of about $306. And in 2007, the personal exemption credit is projected to be $165. So there's a $141 difference between the current law of credit and this quote-unquote credit equivalent. So you can think of Measure 41 as increasing the personal exemption credit in 2007 from $165 to $306.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Chris, when you say it was a revenue raiser, does that mean that was a tax increase, essentially?
Yes, it was so part of the balance rebut, Mr. Chair.
'83, there was a $65 million tax increase. '85, in '85, there was another $85 million tax increase, essentially. And have you calculated out over the years what that change in 1985 indexed to 1986, what the difference in that exemption would have been had it remained the same instead of being changed?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Senator, no, I haven't. You mean if the deduction had stayed constant, how much additional revenue has been raised over time?
Yes, or how much additional tax has been paid.
How much additional tax has been paid. No, I haven't. That could be done. I can look into that and get back to you.
Mm-hmm. And whether this measure would actually restore that, or I mean, you know, if that hadn't been done and it had been a basic linear increase across here, where would that line go? Would it be near where this measure 41 would take us, or not close at all?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Senator, yeah, I can look into that and get back to the committee on that. So that's the context of the history and what Measure 41 would do in terms of the value of the given personal exemption. The next part that I just wanted to touch on was the revenue impact. Generally speaking, Measure 41 reduces revenues by about 7% a year. And again, these are updated figures for the September forecast that you just heard this morning. And for tax year, that 7% in tax year 2007 equates to about $393 million. The table there, the Exhibit 4, and these are exhibits are taken from the larger report, is an attempt to show the impact of Measure 41 in the 0507 biennium and the 0709 biennium, including the interaction with the kicker. So on the left-hand part of that Exhibit 4, the 0507, the impact from Measure 41 is a reduction of $157 million. And that is primarily due to a change in withholding that is expected to recur if Measure 41 passes in the first 6 months of 2007. So that would effectively lower the ending balance from $1.272 billion to $1.1 billion. And that, because the ending balance of 0507 is the beginning balance of 0709, we see in the 0709 column that same $157 million reduction. Now, the revenues for 0709 are projected to be $813 million lower. But the kicker, there's also an effect on the kicker because of the effect on the lower ending balance in 0507, and that the projected kicker of just over $1 billion is lowered by the $157 million. So the kicker falls from just over $1 billion to $886 million. And that's where the general fund revenue there for 0709, which under current law is projected to be $12.5 billion, would then be $11.86 billion, and for a net effect of $656 million reduction in revenues for the 0709 biennium. But for general fund resources, you have the effect on the beginning balance of a reduction of $157 million, and then the combined effect of the revenue reduction and resulting in an $813 million reduction in general fund resources for 0709. One other note, the revenue impact would increase, one of the effects of the decrease in the Oregon tax liability would be a reduction in the state and local tax deduction that itemizers take, and they would then pay more federal taxes, and that would be about $40 million a year. Okay, the next page contains a table of a distributional impact for Measure 41. There are three sections to the tables, all filers and then broken out for single filers and joint filers. In general, the measure is fairly straightforward in that the more personal exemptions a taxpayer claims, the larger their dollar reduction in tax. Joint filers are going to receive the majority of the benefit. They've received about $80 million of the tax cut. And in 07, that would be $313 million of the $393 million. This is largely due because joint filers claim more exemptions. On average, joint filers claim three exemptions as opposed to about one for single filers. Higher income filers would see a larger dollar reduction in tax, but lower income filers would see a larger percentage reduction in tax. And again, that's due to the kind of flat nature of the tax cut. There are three groups who do not benefit from the measure, and those are, as I mentioned earlier, dependents, because they're not allowed to claim personal exemptions. Filers who have no liability under current law, they simply don't benefit. And then certain high-income filers. These are folks who are subject to the phase-out of the federal personal exemption deduction. At certain income levels, the amount of that federal deduction begins to reduce and can be reduced down to zero. And you can see that in the percent affected column. So if you look at all filers, for the first two income groups, those under $10,000 and those between $10,000 and $20,000, only 22% are affected in the first group and 76% are affected in the second group. This is due to largely the dependents and the low-income folks. And for those with incomes over $200,000, only 57% of them are affected in 2007. Now, that there is some variation in that group, and I'll get to that in a minute, because the federal law is changing over the next couple of years with respect to that phase-out. And then lastly, no taxpayer would pay more tax under the measure, because they have the choice of using the credit or the deduction. Presumably, they would choose the one that results in lower tax liability. On the next page, I just wanted to touch on a couple of taxpayer examples that can help provide some insight as to how the effect can vary depending on taxpayer circumstances. Generally, the tax reduction will be $141, again, tax year 07, per personal exemption claimed. So taxpayers A, B, and C are fairly straightforward. Taxpayer A is just a single filer, and you can see that their tax reduction is the $141. They have $30,000 of income, itemize their deductions, and they get the $141 reduction, which is a 7% reduction. Taxpayer B is the dependent, which I've touched on. And then taxpayer C is a family four joint return, $65,000 of income, and they get a $564 reduction, which is four times 141, and that's a 15% reduction. Taxpayer D is a joint return, no kids, and a $275,000 income. And these folks are subject to the phase-out of the personal exemption deduction. So their tax reduction is only $101, which is less than the $282. And so their percent reduction is just 0.5%. Taxpayer E is a head of household filer, two personal exemptions, so single parent, adjusted gross income of $22,000. Their tax impact is $241, which is a little bit less than the 282 basis for two taxpayers. And this is because under current law, the situation of this particular taxpayer results in him or her being in the 9% tax bracket under current law. But under Measure 41, the personal exemption deduction and their taxable income, they end up being in the 7% bracket. So the value of the deduction is kind of broken out in two pieces. You have some of that income is no longer taxed at 9%, but some of it's not taxed at 7%. So their reduction is a little bit less than the two exemptions times 141. The last example shows the interaction between the measure and some of Oregon's refundable credits. That's a head of household filer, three personal exemptions, $27,000 of income, and a $1,000 refundable credit, say a working family credit. Under current law, their tax liability is $311. So before the application of that refundable credit, their tax liability is $1,311. Under Measure 41, their liability prior to the application of that refundable credit is $888. So they have $888. Measure 41 has reduced their liability. Then they applied that refundable credit of $1,000. So they wind up with a tax under Measure 41 liability of -$112. The negative liability is simply the amount of the refundable credit that will go back to them. So their tax reduction is actually $423. You take that as a percentage of their current law tax liability, and their reduction is 136%. So you get variations in the dollar change as well as the percentage change depending on taxpayer circumstances. The last thing I wanted to touch on was the interaction between Measure 41 and the federal phase-out of personal exemptions. Because the measure ties to the federal exemptions claimed on the return, how the federal law changes over time will directly affect these taxpayers. So let me back up a little bit. Under the EGTRA tax cuts, the tax cuts of 2001, one component of that tax reduction bill was an elimination of the phase out of the personal exemptions. It did it gradually over time. In 2006, that reduction amount was reduced by one third. In 2008, it will be reduced by another third. And then for tax year 2010, there is no phase out of the personal exemption deduction. That under current federal law, that expires after 2010. So in 2011, the phase out is reinstated in its pre-AGDRA form. And you can see that in the percent affected column. In 2007, 57% of the folks with income above $200,000 are affected by the measure. But then in 2008, that goes up to just nearly everybody becomes affected because the amount of that phase out has been reduced. So they are essentially claiming more personal, they'll be allowed to claim more personal exemption deductions in 2008. And then that amount holds until 2010. And then 2011, the percent affected falls back to closer to the 50% mark, which is kind of the pre-EGTRA phase out. And you can and then the dollar impact is shown in the total state tax reduction. And in 2010, when there is no phase out, this tax group, these 55,000 taxpayers, would have a tax cut of $26 million, but then in 2011, that tax reduction is roughly cut in half, down to $13.7 million, unless the federal law changes. Again, these are under current federal law.
If I can add one thing, Mr. Chair, just thinking about kind of process here, if Measure 41 passes, usually there's a little bit of a speed up in the forecast process and an effort to get some final numbers to the governor in early to mid-November. And so, that forecast process would go as normal. There would be some adjustments to the numbers you just saw, but then something in the neighborhood of this $813 million, if Measure 41 passes, would be taken out of that, and the governor would have to reflect that lower number in
his balanced
budget. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it would be incorporated in the December forecast and in the governor's budget.
Huh. I didn't know that. By December, you would have accounted for it.
Right. That'll be accounted for in that December forecast. And, of course, you'll know it going into the session. That'll be just in current law projections.
Well, there you have it. Measure 48. We've got the kicker, 48, and now 41, the research reports from our Legislative Revenue Office. Thank you very much. They're timely and should come in handy. Senator Whitsitt.
A question. I want a clarification from Chris. I understand that our projected ending 07 balance less our projected August 7th kicker refund is that balance is zero or a negative number.
Mm-hmm.
You had $157 million that this would be a tax reduction in 05-07 on this Measure 41. But did I hear you say that the kicker would actually zero that out?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Senator, that's correct. That $157 million reduction in the revenues for 0507, which is reflected in the change in that ending balance for 0507, reduces the kicker by that amount.
Thank you.
Other thoughts or questions? Do we know where this would put us in terms of? I believe the last numbers we had, Paul, were 42nd in terms of the share that we pay and ranking of 50 states.
Mr. Chair, yeah, if you,
oh, you
on
got
the
it.
Larger table,
you've done it.
Exhibit 6 on page 7 shows the ranking.
You've already done it.
And so this assumes that there are no changes in any other states, and the reduction for Oregon is a 7% reduction, which is the magnitude of the Measure 41.
So we'd move to 44th. You've already done this. Wow. Well, as my friend said, we're six.
Chris has already done it.
Yeah, he's already done that. Well, who said that? We're on our way to 50th in terms of lowest personal share of taxes.
Mr. Chair, these are 03, 04 numbers that we just got in June. So they're the new census numbers.
So these are updated.
Right.
So updated. I can say 42nd. I get asked every once in a while. So we 42nd in terms of, are we a high tax state or low tax state? Mm-hmm. Pretty definitively a lower tax state than most, other than 6 or 7 here.
check out those states, too.
That's true. That's our company that we're keeping. Any other questions or thoughts for the panel that we have? Thank you very much. Really appreciate it. Right on time at noon. So,
Mr. Chair, just remind the committee, we've got one more meeting, so and we'll need to talk about, are we going to have two more meetings?
I think two is what we're hoping for. I was going to ask Senator Starr.
Okay. But our last meeting, we need to think in terms of what kind of pre-session file bills you would like to have as committee bills. So that's something to be thinking about. I need to get those drafts going, and any help you need from us, just let us know.
Right. Yeah.
Now, the one I know is November 22nd. When is the other one? You said two meetings.
I was thinking we'd have that. We don't have one on September 22nd.
No.
Or what date?
No, that's, you're thinking, Senator, about the e-board and the floor session.
And that's the 21st.
21st and 22nd.
September 21st is when we have the confirmation.
Executive appointment.
Board.
Right. The September 21st thing I'm aware of. But right. Your other, you just said you wanted two more meetings.
It's going to be November.
Yeah, I said November.
And then probably a December one.
November
is what I
22nd,
thought.
I thought it was. Right before Thanksgiving.
That's when we have a forecast release.
Right.
That's correct. So we could. That could, you're correct, Senator. That's when that comes out.
So the one,
you're ahead of
so
us.
The one,
wow.
Would be, the one would be November 22nd then, and the other one you're saying would be in December?
You're ahead of me, Senator Shields. So September, yeah, we may try to combine like we did today, November 22nd.
Well,
and then do one.
I just
other.
Assumed you always did that because that's how you've always done it so far.
We're like a well-ticking time piece.
I thought he was going to say well-ticking time bomb.
The only thing that's a little different on that, Senator, sometimes, I mean, in the past, it is the forecast that comes out with the governor's budget. So sometimes they like to do a presentation that combines the whole thing at some point. But yeah. The governor's budget has to be done. Unless we have a new governor, then it's not due until January.
Elections definitely clouding the fiscal certainty of the state, both on these and chief executive and others. Senator Starr, any thoughts before we adjourn till November 22nd, at least for this committee?
No.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Senate revenue is adjourned, and I think it will be November 22nd. Will probably be our next meeting.